Solve, secure, protect. Look to Patel for the independent thinking and cross-disciplinary focus it takes to advance security and safety in a changing world. They provide their clients with integrated solutions that secure our nation and help solve challenges within infrastructure, environment, emerging threats, and deployable mission-ready technology. Their teams leverage their deep expertise to develop science and technology for a healthier, safer, and more sustainable world. Visit Patel.org to learn how Patel makes the impossible possible. Welcome to From the Crow's Nest, a podcast on electromagnetic spectrum operations, or EMSO. I'm your host, Ken Miller, Director of Advocacy and Outreach for the Association of Old Crows. Thanks for listening. In this episode of From the Crow's Nest, I share with you a conversation I had with representatives from the 55th Electronic Combat Group, the Compass Call community, during my visit to Davis Monthan Air Force Base back in January. Now, as many of you know, the Compass Call is recognized by the venerable EC-130H aircraft, but the Compass Call is more than just an airframe, it's also a mission. And the U.S. Air Force is in the process of replacing the aging C-130 airframe with a more operationally relevant EA-37B airframe, EA standing for Electronic Attack, and which is a variant of the Gulfstream. This process has been less than smooth at times than it needs to be. And you know, from an AOC perspective, we support the delivery of additional EA-37B aircraft and, of course, on a faster time frame. Time schedule than they currently are, but there is progress being made on that front, and we applaud the Air Force for the work being done. But really, the takeaway from my visit with the Compass Call community was, of course, just how critical the Compass Call mission is today to successful EMSO operations, and just how amazing this community is at conducting their mission and the pride they take in it. It was really refreshing to be out there, spend the day with them. I greatly appreciate them taking time from their busy schedule. They're high demand mission, and they're always on the go. So it was great to spend some time with them, sit down with them, and learn a little bit more about where they're at today. Now, before I get to that interview, for those who listened to last week's bonus episode on what is going on in Congress these days, you'll know that the president's budget was delivered to Capitol Hill this week. That's kind of the big milestone that everyone in D.C. is talking about, and probably only people in D.C. are talking about it. But the main talking point, of course, is that the president's budget every year in and year out, is dead on arrival until Congress gets its hands on it. The fact is, the truth is that much of this budget remains intact through the appropriations process. So it really does give you an idea of where the budget is going throughout the fiscal year. This is especially true with the defense budget. Congress will play around with some of the major initiatives, but the bulk of the defense budget is going to remain intact. So the president's budget calls for $849.8 billion for the Department of Defense in FY 2025. And that's about a 4.1% increase over fiscal year 2024. Now, there'll be folks in Congress on both sides saying either that needs to be a higher number or a lower number. And those views do not break down along party lines. Those views are represented on both sides of the aisle. So there'll be some talk about what that final number will be. But that's the starting point, is $849.8 billion. There are also several interesting EMSO priorities highlighted in the budget. Of course, in addition to the E-18G Growler capability modifications, there's support for the next generation jammer to improve electronic attack capabilities. There's also funding for the F-15 Eagle passive active warning and survivability system, and the integrated defensive electronic countermeasure system for the F-18, for all F-18 aircraft. There is also the direction that the Department of the Air Force must achieve electromagnetic dominance to maintain information advantage, so the establishment of electromagnetic spectrum operations center of excellence. And then there are also plans to accelerate EC-37B baseline by transferring resources from the retiring EC-130H Compass Call aircraft to this new EA-37B variant. There are other initiatives that support the CHIPS Act on microelectronics, as well as other critical technologies in hypersonic weapons, electronic warfare, nuclear modernization, and so forth. And then finally, of course, there is from the from the Sea Power perspective, there's money in there for the Surface Electronic Improvement Program, the Block 3, and some additional money for C4ISR systems. So all that to say is there's a lot in the budget. We're still going through getting the numbers for some of these initiatives. We'll bring all that to you as we get them, you either on the show, on From the Crow's Nest, or you can look for articles in the AOC's weekly eCrow newsletter that comes out on Wednesdays. But again, we'll try to provide this information for you as much as we can, as quickly as we can. All right, so that was a lot. I greatly appreciate your patience as we go through some of that, but I felt it was really important to give you an update that, you know, where we're standing at on the annual defense budget process. So now I would like to take you to my interview with the 55th Electronic Combat Group to discuss today's Compass Call mission. Let's listen in. I am pleased to be here with a team from the 55th Electronic Combat Group, the Compass Call, out here at Davis-Monthan Air Force Base. And I'm also here with my subject matter expert and senior analyst, Matt Thompson. And I'll go around and we'll introduce everybody here, but I'm here with Lieutenant Colonel Jesse Polchek, as well as First Lieutenant Colin Schultz. I first want to thank you all for opening the doors and welcoming us here for our visit this week. It's been a great morning with you, getting up to speed on the Compass Call, and of course the arrival in the near future here of the EA-37B and the impact that that's going to have on the mission and the improved capability and all that's going on there. So really appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule, and thank you for joining me here on From the Crow's Nest. So just to begin, for our listeners, we'll go around, and if you could just say your name and kind of a little bit of how you fit into the leadership structure here at the 55th.
Oh, yeah. Easy day. So Lieutenant Colonel Jesse Palchik, I'm the 55th Electronic Group Deputy Commander, so working under Colonel Olson, who's the 06 for the group, and a relative new group member to the family, but basically bring a lot of expertise from my SOCOM background and then some electronic attack background from that. And just help with the big part of the leadership team at the group.
Yep. So I'm Lieutenant Schultz. So I'm just a line flyer here. I've been here for a couple of years. I just went through upgrade to be a mission crew commander. So the lead EO on any particular flight. I'm just flying lines once, twice a week, and just trying to get better at my job every day.
To begin, obviously the thrust of our conversation is going to be about, you know, transitioning the Compass Call aircraft, the EC-130, to the EA-37B. And just to get us started, could you tell us a little bit about the current aircraft you have, the EC-130 Compass Call, and what kind of capabilities and limitations it brings to the current to your current fight?
Do some high level stuff. I'll turn it to Lieutenant Schultz, kind of be more detailed so you can fill in the gaps.
Great.
So big picture, right? So EC-130H, very legacy old airplane. A lot of the things, airplanes were built during Vietnam. They were inherited here and became active in 1982. From capability perspective, start off with basics, just comms jamming, where it first started with, and over the years incorporated more. So going against radars, more advanced data links, things in the future, then kind of going into meshing in with the other electronic attack assets. So the Growler from the Navy, and previously the Prowler when the Marines, the Navy flew that. And then going into the future, building and integrating with fifth gen and eventually sixth when NGAD comes online. A big part of the pie when going against the electromagnetic spectrum and then superiority across the entire spectrum. And so, like I said, we're a big part of the joint fight and sort of the MSO-GEMSO concept.
And you said, you know, the airframe's been around a long time, I think well over 40 years. But it's obviously the mission has been continually upgraded. How challenging has it been to figure out how to meet those mission requirements? And just, you still have the old airframe, it doesn't fly high, it doesn't, you know, whatever. So how challenging is it to kind of make sure that you can continue to do that mission?
Yeah, so from our partners in, let's say, PACOM, and across the world, so the age of the airplane, so speed, altitude makes it hard to integrate in the current fight. And that kind of leads into the EA-37 when that comes online, higher, faster. And then in terms of the actual mission set, next I'll probably transition to you for this, is the better integrations of our new capabilities. So everything's been kind of hodgepodge together. And then the EA-37 will allow us to bring it all together into the weapon system versus sort of add-ons and tack-ons.
For sure, it's a little before my time talking about Afghanistan and stuff like that, but I think it was really kind of the perfect platform for that. It could be there for a long time, had really good longevity in the air refuelable. And, just talking about being able to kind of strap on different capabilities. So, you know, we had our classic counter-com, counter-radar, stuff like that, some that was used more than others, and the kind of coin stuff that ECG's been doing for the last 20 years or so. But getting to kind of build on with more of those advanced profiles and pretty much just be a giant flying transmitter that you can kind of stick a lot of stuff onto and just see how it works, I think really put us in a good spot for the EA-37 to say like, hey, it's cool that we have all these things. It would be even better if it worked more seamlessly.
Key part of our visit here is to kind of come up to speed with the Compass Call mission in anticipation of the EA-37B arriving here sometime spring. And what's great about any new aircraft is the minute that it arrives, everything just flips right over and you've got that. So no, but could you give us a little bit of insight into the plan for because this transition plan is going to be multi-year, a lot of different moving parts, different pieces that you constantly have to fit and refit into it. So could you give us a little bit of information on the plan to transition from the EC-130 to the EA-37B?
Yeah. So I'll kind of give an overlining a timeline. So the sunsetting of the EC-130 has already started roughly in the past 2 years. We're decorating slowly over time, where the last two aircraft will sunset at the end of FY26. And at that point, I think it's six aircraft by then, at that point, when we kind of swap over with the full buy plan to be up to 10 aircraft, eventually fully completing in FY31. So like I said, full transition over, EC-130 sunsets in FY26, end of FY26, and at the end of that being FY27, the new A37B comes online as the Compass Call.
And the first airframe is delivered here in spring. Do you have a time for that?
End of March.
End of March.
The first aircraft here at DM to start getting the pilots spun up on a fly a modern G550.
But that is not, for our listeners, that is not the initial operating capability of it. So how long will it take to get to that point, as well as when does the second one come, or third one?
So the bigger thing in terms of when it's in more of an operational aircraft. So some of the bigger things for the timeline really would be the end of FY25 is when we'll have a full fielding recommendation for when the aircraft will be technically IOC at that point.
What are some of the key differences? Obviously, just the eye test, you can tell like it's dramatically different. So what are some of the key differences that you can share with us in terms of what the new EA-37B can do?
Yeah. So I guess we'll share this one too, but from the higher level, higher, faster, more capable, right? So old C-130 can't keep up with the current strike packages. It's a big planning consideration for wherever we go in the world. Higher, better line of sight, get through those photons further, affect more systems, and then more capable. And I'll hand it to you, Lieutenant Schultz, about better integrated and better future capability. So what am I missing out?
Absolutely. So we have very similar capabilities as far as what our jamming capabilities are, but better in a lot of ways. Like I said, it's kind of more seamless, especially with the kind of clip-in stuff that we can do. But that being said, if you're just looking at not doing coin anymore and looking at the near peer, like you got to be farther away. You got to be able to get away faster, essentially, if we had to. Looking at that, that's kind of the biggest factor. And just having more power, essentially, in what we're doing, having kind of our miniaturized components making us kind of lighter and that kind of stuff, and being more seamless, having newer radios, just the maintenance reliability rate, just having that 90%-ish availability rate is going to be huge for us, both getting reps at home as well as, you know, for any kind of conflict in the future.
What is the availability rate now of the current? I know that's kind of hard maybe with the sundown, but...
Yeah, it's a challenge. So okay. I'll put it that way, okay. Right? So old airplanes, fewer and fewer. And globally speaking, the Air Force has gone away from the H model C-130. So it's hard to maintain an airplane that the larger DOD doesn't really support anymore. So it's a continual challenge as a... Me and actually, I think two people here that tried to fly yesterday found out.
I tried to fly yesterday.
Too. All of us didn't happen. It didn't happen. So yeah. It can be very challenging.
So I want to go back to Lieutenant Schultz. You know, you mentioned a few of the things that the new EA-37B is going to have. What are some of a couple of the real key capability improvements that you're most excited about seeing in the field? Or another way, obviously with, you know, security challenges around the world as they are today, I mean, the minute... The EA-37B is fielded. It's going to be, we know it's going to be in high demand. and it's going to be more equipped to adapt to a real dynamic threat environment. So with this aircraft, you know, can you talk about somehow it'll be a little bit easier maybe to keep pace with the changing threat than the current EC-130, open systems architecture, how plug and play capability, how does that play into the new variant coming on board?
Absolutely. So kind of like we were talking about before with the EC, big flying transmitter, a lot of cables, you can kind of plug anything in there as long as it's more or less designed for it. And then we kind of find out if it works based on testing, stuff like that. So having our future aircraft have the kind of open, the, can I say Saber?
Yeah, you can say, okay. Saber. You can say Saber and Sword.
So we're going to have the Saber architecture that's going to eventually become Sword, which is, we can think of it as like an app store, kind of, like you said, open architecture. We can have a lot of different players design stuff for us that if, you know, all of a sudden, you know, country X comes out with this new thing, whereas it might have taken, I don't know what the timeline would be, a lot longer than it would now. They can say like, hey, we can create this waveform. We can create this package that we know is going to work with your architecture. And then we can see if that waveform works, as opposed to seeing if the technology works and then see if the waveform works.
Yeah. And I can bring it up to a bigger thing too. So, you know, classically speaking, right? So you and your compadre behind you have done this game a lot in terms of updating jamming waveforms or whatever the enemy is creating. So it's a continual cat and mouse game of who can do something better first. And then really, speed is what helps, right? Whoever is able to change what they're doing faster, and you hit the nail on the head, right? So open architecture, rapid reprogramming, things aren't tied down to a very unique way of doing business, allows us to adapt to whatever the adversary is doing. Mm-hmm. And then we can create counters they're doing and just try to get ahead of them. So like I said, Boyd said it very well. So he moves faster, does better.
Well, and over the last several months, you know, we've had the opportunity to go down to Warner Robins, engage the 350 Spectrum Warfare Wing. We've been really impressed with the steps the Air Force has taken to really improve its capabilities in the EW space. That's got to give you at least a good feeling as the EA-37B arrives, that, you know, the Air Force understands a lot better today the need for EW than maybe some of the years past. And how has 350th and some of the other changes that have happened at the Air Force helped this transition?
I'm going to add some color in your statement about 350th. So you're 100% right. The Air Force is reinventing itself a little bit in the EW world, right? I think we're still recovering from fighting COIN for a long time. But we still have a long ways to go. So we're creating a lot of organizations now, like 350th Spectrum Warfare Wing, great. But the amount of EW professionals out there is smaller. So my original airframe, AC-130 gunship, EWOs don't exist on that anymore. B-52 is getting rid of their EWO too. So we are creating organizations that will foster advances and keeping pace with our pacing threats, but we're still a long ways to go in building the professionals to do that. And to be honest with you, Compass Call is probably one of the founding areas for that, since B-52 doesn't have an EWO, gunships don't have an EWO, B-1s are going away. So your professional EWOisms really are coming from the RJ and from the Compass Call.
Hello, everyone. I want to take a short break to thank Battelle for their continued support for our From the Crow's Nest podcast. It's always great to hear from them, and I am pleased to be here with Rusty Colemorgan, Navy veteran and division manager at Battelle. Rusty, thanks for joining me here on From the Crow's Nest. It's great to have you on the show.
Hey, thanks very much, and thanks for the opportunity.
You've had an interesting career with extensive stints in the Navy and industry. What brought you to Battelle, and how does your experience align with Battelle's mission?
Yeah, thanks for that, Ken. And I did have a very rewarding career as a Navy pilot. And as I transitioned through a number of companies in industry, I continued to have great experiences because I got the chance to work alongside eye-watering technical talent. What I'm most excited about at Battelle is how our campus is literally surrounded by an impressive depth of relevant applied researchers. That uniquely embedded in-house research capability serves as a foundation as we focus on solutions to the world's hardest problems. We strive to create a better world through science, and the RavenStar technology is the latest example of a hard problem with wide society benefits.
In the past, we've heard here on From the Crow's Nest from your colleagues, Doug Thornton and Molly Engel. They provided some intriguing insights about the RavenStar antenna. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about the challenges of this trade space and what you're trying to address with this game-changing technology?
The bottom line is that users have had to sub-optimize their capabilities and needs with traditional design approaches in the RF spectrum. Traditionally, electronic warfare and command and control users want a number of capabilities that create a challenging design space. Those needs are typically long ranges, maximum throughput, and low probability of intercept, low probability of detection. They want those ranges for more effective operational reach or standoff, and they want more throughput for the increased data that leads to actionable intelligence. And those tight control of the emissions, they want those for either maximizing energy on a particular bearing or limiting the ability to detect or interfere with their emissions. It's not an easy trade space, but the flexibility of the Ravenstar architecture gives them more of what they want operationally.
So what does the Ravenstar do that makes it optimize across these critical performance needs, and how does that stand out from traditional approaches?
Well, our frequency agility gives operators flexibility to work an ultra-wide portion of the spectrum through a single low-swap software-defined aperture. Ravenstar co-designed extremely wide-band aperture arrays with co-located advanced electronics. This allows a compact, frequency-flexible RF solution. Our approach minimizes conventional antenna feature trade-off and allows significant design flexibility for delivering the spectrum dominance that's needed.
We've been tracking this program here on the show. How mature is Ravenstar today?
We put it at a TRL 6 after testing that we've done in December of 2023, and continuing into this year, we'll do field tests, accompany lab demonstrations, and development performance on formal efforts with different DoD customers, all that are pointed toward a continued maturation of the Ravenstar design. They show the Ravenstar's ability is to support all domain missions that require multiple communications.
Well, thank you, Rusty, for joining me here on the show. It's always great to hear from the Patel team. And now it's time to get back to our show. That gets me into the next question. I want to talk a little bit about the training challenges. Could you talk a little bit about how the roles of the air crew changes and how you're addressing some of the training challenges that arise from taking, you know, the personnel from one aircraft into another, from in terms of roles and responsibilities, and then how are you tackling the training challenge?
Yeah, so that's a kind of an evolving thing between the new EC-1, sorry, EA-37.
It's good to know that we both do that.
Yeah. What's in a letter, right? A lot of work, actually.
A lot of work going
into the letter.
That's something that's a continuing discussion we have about that when baseline 3 comes online and then baseline 4. Because like you said, perfectly, smaller crew relying on technology, a lot of cool things we're doing to help with that. But actually, I think you guys over at the BATS probably know more than I do of how we're mitigating the smaller crew, which is much, much smaller occurring.
Sure, yeah. So one of the big things in the EC-130, we have a very analog system for talking to each other. We have set channels where you can only talk to specific crew members, which kind of made the navigator, which is going to go away, into a crucial piece between the flight deck and the mission crew in the back. So my understanding is we're going to have all digital intercom for everyone, so you can set up specific channels between just the mission crew commander and the pilot, for example, if you want to need to have that back and forth as opposed to needing to go through different people. So I think we're using technology in that way to kind of increase our crew resource management and make sure that that's working more efficiently.
And that's actually something I can touch on too. So sure. My external perspective. So remember, I originally came from gunships, and in that, the front end, back end, all fighting together. And so unless opposed to currently with the EC-130, there's a bit of a wall between the front end and the back end. And then to make better use of the entire crew is integrating everyone together. So they're all fighting the same fight and the same basically fires net, if you will. So like I said, I did a lot of real world fires, but in this, the compass call, whether the EC-130, EA-37, is electronic fires. And the solution to really having a smaller crew is better integration with the smaller amount of people you have. And like I said, the new aircraft will help that a lot. I've seen the new ISCS system. It's pretty neat.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. And I think they're still working on some bugs, but you can call individual stations, create subnets. It's pretty cool.
I want to bring in our senior analyst, Matt Thompson, for a question on this.
Yeah. So I just want to go back to something that you kind of, you know, were talking about earlier and just kind of ask the question a different way. So I think sometimes it's easy to overlook just the benefits of getting in the new car. So when Ken asked earlier, like, what are you most excited about? Like, you know, I think we're talking about at that level, you know, new platform, you know, shiny new toy, getting out of something that's, you know, probably been flying for 1,000 hours before you were born. Like, you know, what kind of excitement do you have on those kind of things?
Yeah, so that's definitely exciting, and I think it kind of goes back to how the Air Force is posturing itself too. It definitely makes me, as someone, you know, new to the Air Force, new to EW, feel like, you know, we're valued, we're important. It's something that they care about. So having that just belief in us that we can get this new platform, I mean, yeah, it's just cool to have. It's going to be cool to have the newest platform in the Air Force. Like, that's not anything I ever thought, and it's honestly so contrary to how this community's been for the last 40 years, where we're one of the oldest platforms at this point. So I think we're used to just like doing our best, getting along with whatever we have to, which I think is going to be a really good mindset moving forward, that we can have that perseverance whilst having an even better, you know, maintenance rate.
So when I was first introduced to the Compass call, it was probably, well, I want to say late 90s, 2000 timeframe, when I was on Capitol Hill. And we used to put together these Compass call awareness days, which were fantastic events. You know, we had the people come out to brief. Eventually, then we were able to actually get an airframe from Davis-Monthan to come out to Andrews, park at Andrews, have tours, and talk with the crew. And I always found that was some of the most interesting times. And since then, I've always enjoyed engaging the crew and engaging the community. Really appreciate the job that you do. Could you tell us a little bit about just serving in the community from a human perspective, from a service member perspective, what it's like to be a part of the Compass Call community, where you're at today, and kind of where that's going to go here as the new 37 model comes in?
Sure. Yeah. So we're going to have a smaller crew. We'll be missing some of our folks that have been around here for a long time, navs, flight engineers, that kind of stuff. But to me, at least, it feels kind of like a family, just because this is the only place we are. People stick around here for a long time,
and because it's such a specialty, quite a few, I would imagine, that start and end their career right here at Davis-Monthan.
Absolutely, yeah. It's not uncommon for people to start here, go do a staff tour, and come back here. So yeah, there's definitely a lot of experience, and being that EW is so kind of niche, obviously there's other platforms that have, like, you know, EW pods and stuff like that that'll do, but I understand it's more of like a set it and forget it type of thing. So the fact that we have to be so active in the process kind of makes us feel like more connected, I guess, in that we're like, well, listen, we're the kind of the only people that do this, at least on the Air Force side. Obviously, there's the growlers. So I think that makes us feel like we need to do a good job, and that we're kind of in our own little niche over here.
You come out here, you look at the numbers, you're like, wow, there's, you know, 800 plus people as part of the detachment or the group here. Seems like a lot, but obviously your operational tempo is tremendous. You always have new tasks that you have to respond to. Not enough people, quite frankly. So could you tell us a little bit about how, maybe give us some insight, just generally speaking, in terms of how often do you deploy, and what is a typical, like, take us inside from a service member perspective, not from a technical perspective, but just take us into the back of the EC-130 here to talk about, like, who's back there and who is a part of your team.
Sure. Yeah. So typical deployment for us is just total case by case basis. Usually it comes totally out of the blue. So-and-so wants you to do this thing at this place.
Right.
So usually it's a kind of a process of, like, senior leadership deciding, like, hey, can we do this? As far as, like, the human service member perspective, we have our times that we know we're up for deployment. So, and we can see who's going to be on our crew. So it's definitely a small enough community that, you know, everybody, mm-hmm. for sure, especially all the flyers, you know, out of that 800, I don't even want to guess, but, like, it's a smaller percentage of that for sure. So, you know, having that opportunity to fly with pretty much everybody, probably at least once a week, you fly with a few people. So, we don't do hard crews here when we train, but when we deploy, we do. So
there's two operational squadrons here, the 41st and the 43rd. When I was out here the last time, spent the day with the 43rd, spending most of the time here over the 41st. You, Lieutenant Schultz, are from the 43rd, as I've just realized. So welcome here to the other side here. But could you tell us a little bit about the differences between the operational squadrons, kind of how the duties break down, or just kind of how the squadrons are organized here?
Yeah, absolutely. So flight deck, as in pilots, flight engineers, navs, EWOs are all essentially agnostic. You can be you know, it does, we don't break it apart that way. So we still have, you know, set all those crew positions per squadron. But the big breakdown is definitely the AOR focus. So the 41st has more of like the CENTCOM type languages as well as Russian. And then the 43rd focuses on Indo-PACOM and SOUTHCOM. So while the EOs are agnostic per each squadron, we definitely have more of a focus on like the 43rd members will know more about Indo-PACOM systems. And then the 41st will know more about CENTCOM. So when we deploy, it doesn't necessarily work that way other than the linguists, but that's kind of how it's supposed to be broken down if for some reason we had to support two different AORs.
Great. And just to wrap up, a couple last questions here from just an education and awareness standpoint, because from the Crow's Nest here, we get about, you know, 5,000-6,000 downloads a month, you know, a lot of new listeners each month. What do you want our audience to know about who you are, what you do, and kind of where you're going with, obviously, with the new variant coming on board?
So I guess the biggest thing, right, is that we are the Air Force's only manned electronic attack asset, and we fill a crucial role in MSO-GEMSO, supporting blue forces and denying red advantages, right? So like in open media, right, B-21 gets a lot of press, F-35 gets a lot of press, but they don't operate on their own. And the Compass Call serves a key role in that larger fight across the DoD, not just in the Air Force. And so like even the Growler, they are good at things, we're good at other things, and we're a big part of the joint fight. And the capabilities we develop are ones that are helping out everyone else across the spectrum of warfare. Like I said, we spent a lot of time in COIN, got really good at that. And right now we're regenerating our capabilities for that massive force on force. The Army would say full tilt boogie warfare is what they would call. But that's what we're kind of driving for now to get us all modernized up and one unit fight against people that might outnumber us. And so we can take our technological advantages ahead and win the fight.
And the From the Crow's Nest podcast obviously is a product of the Association of Old Crows. So, you know, what can the association do to help you in this effort?
So advocacy is huge, right? I've always said that if you want to win any argument, you have a lot of friends. And if you socialize enough things widely, then things change, right? One loud voice is okay, but if all of them is yelling the same message, it's even better. So I think we've hinted at it before. Training is an important thing. And the Air Force, I would say maybe the entire military forgets about this sometimes, is building that infrastructure for good training. I have an old saying that sometimes you've got toys and sometimes you've got tools. Toys are cool, unique capabilities, a lot of people know how to use. Tools are things that are well trained to when you have the infrastructure to train to it. And that's where we really need help, to be honest with you, and the helping with the advocacy piece. From the front back, pilots, sometimes they're forgotten about this community, nothing against you guys, but we're trying many efforts through ACC and then HAF to get us a WST, so a weapon system trainer for the front end for the new aircraft, so that our pilots are proficient and we can take the aircraft anywhere. And for the back end, we have a sim on the line, but it needs to keep pace with the aircraft. We kind of talked earlier about keeping pace with our enemies, but to make sure that we as humans can do that, our training tools have to keep pace. That's something we help with too, is showing that just one and done isn't going to do it. That we got to be able to keep pace and palm for it appropriately so the money flows and resources come. So that's some of the biggest thing is helping us build our infrastructure for training for the entire aircraft so we support the DoD.
Yeah, I would just say for that, just kind of like you were saying, the idea that like, hey, it's funded, cool, we're good for EW, like move on, go fund the next thing. But you know, as we've mentioned, it's a cat and mouse thing. It's constantly evolving. So just realizing that it's not going to be a one and done thing. And then, you know, just education as far as what we do, because even a lot of people in the Air Force don't really understand what we do or think we can do everything at once or think that we can be in every AOR at every time. And, you know, maybe someday with enough aircraft, we'd be able to do that. But as currently planned and funded, we're still going to be a very limited resource as far as where we can be at one time.
And that's a valid point. So kind of referring back to other similar open source discussions, right? So you see B-21 all over the headlines, and the headline is we need more B-21. I would say the same for the EA-37 Bravo. Need more of that to cover both sides of the world if need be, or even just for one fight, having more so we can sustain the joint force.
Lieutenant Colonel Palchik and Lieutenant Schultz, I really greatly appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule to join me. I'll let you get back to your day, and I really appreciate you joining me here on From the Crow's Nest. Thank you very much.
That will conclude this episode of From the Crow's Nest. I want to thank my guest, Dr. David Thirdacre, for joining me. Again, if you're an AOC member, look for an email with information on how to join our next recording of our bonus subscription episode next week. If you're not an AOC member, you can still access that episode when it is released next Wednesday. Also, please take a moment to review, share, and follow our show. We always enjoy hearing from our listeners, so please let us know how we're doing. That's it for today. Thanks for listening. This podcast is brought to you by Battelle, the world's largest independent, not-for-profit, applied science and technology organization. Since 1929, their mission has been to translate scientific discovery and technology advances to benefit society. Through markets such as health, environment, infrastructure, industry, and national security, Battelle has been delivering cutting-edge solutions that impact the well-being of the world and help keep us safe at home. To learn more, go to battelle.org/connect. That's BATTELLE.org/connect.